Hola, hello, hi, bienvenido, welcome back, or welcome to Mentors Today. Ileana, hello there, how are you?
Hi, Rob. Hi, everybody. Hola, hola. ¿Cómo están?
How's it going in Guadalajara?
Fine. We are in the middle of holidays.
It is. Easter coming up, Palm Sunday last week. So not a lot of work getting done in Guadalajara this week. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the city is kind of empty because everybody's going to have fun in the beach.
Yeah, except for you. You're not going to the beach. We Americanized you. You just work right through the holidays.
Yeah, I'm tired of the spring breakers.
All right. So speaking of America and the Americas, which is what we talk about in our show all the time, today we're super excited to have a guest who's going to help us bring Canada into the discussion for the first time in our 70-plus episodes of this show. So let me tell you about our guest. We're joined by a great friend of mine. We're super excited to have Jeffrey Potvin. Jeff is the founder, general partner at Open People Network and the Supporters Fund. Jeff is himself a multiple successful entrepreneur and angel investor. He's invested in over 70 companies. He's a member of several angel groups and screening committees, including in the areas in and around where he lives, the Toronto, York, Park Program, and GTAN. He's also the driving force behind the Open People Network, or OPN, which is a group of angel investors that helps accelerate the growth of early stage startups, and really active through the Supporters Fund. Got a background in software engineering and e-commerce management and has weird, crazy amounts of depth and experience building and reinventing multiple businesses. He's particularly interested in investing in some of the areas that come up when you look at his backgrounds, deep tech, fintech related stuff, retail products, e-commerce. He is a mentor to coach. He's a mountain climber, adventurous outdoors person, and literally like almost a semi-professional world traveler. He's passionate about discovering early stage companies and founders with innovative solutions to solving real problems. And he's really excited about the pace of change with things like automation, robotics, AI, software in the broadest sense of bringing to all industries. Ilay, let's welcome Jeffrey Potvin joining us from Toronto.
Welcome, Jeffrey, or JP, if you want to call. Bienvenido.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for us too. And we want to start, as Rob just said, you're the first Canadian guest that we have here in Mentors Today. So we want to know more about how does the entrepreneurial economy look like in Canada?
Well, first, I want to start off by saying it's a pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan of what you guys have put together, not just from the podcast, but overall in general, the work and help you're doing to support startups all over the world. You know, it does start in one area, but it broadcasts out. And I think that's the best part of this platform and what you guys have put together. And it's pretty amazing. So I'm glad to be here. And I thank you on behalf of Canadians for asking myself to jump in. So hopefully I can do the honor of helping support Canadian ecosystem on your channel. I think to kind of take a step into where and how the economies look like in today's world or in the past 5 years and where they're going, is there's been obviously a big push in the Canadian ecosystem for deep tech or technologists and innovation. I think everybody's aware of it. They push it a lot. It's marketed everywhere that Canada is the spot to go if you want to build a company. And they have programs that they've built to bring in companies, which is the Startup Visa Program, SVP. It's very popular. So this is something that has been well known and well trafficked, I guess, around the world for entrepreneurs. It compares to, you know, Startup Chile, where they provide money and give you a spot for 8 months to work, which I think is phenomenal. And they're doing this in more countries now where they're looking at this as a ecosystem builder, but it creates jobs, it creates value in a country. And the more foreign startup founders you can bring into a country, the more new creation of jobs you can bring in. And that brings layers and layers into the GDP, and that's a huge value. So where has the innovation started today? Well, if you take a look back, you know, in the 60s and 70s, there was a document that was created 100 to 300 pages long. I read it a long time ago, but it was created, where does Canada want to be in 50 years? And the idea behind it was that Canada wants to be the brain power. You know, we're not a labor-based country. We're too small. We don't have the population to support that. So we need to be able to change the dynamics of who we are. And over the last 50 years, that's what they did. They enabled the country to be top in schooling and education, innovation, technology, putting money in from government funding into startups, building a base around that. And what that's created today is that you have a very large ecosystem that supports and really dives into the value of entrepreneurship. It's not supported as equally across all provinces, but it certainly does from a tax perspective, angels, government support. There's such a growth opportunity that's happening. And what this does is it's actually turned Canada into that brain position of strategic people that are really helping businesses grow and helping them scale and get to where they need to be. But that also creates innovation, because when you allow for that to happen in a new economy, you have more people focused on strategy and building out. Well, then you eventually have them being pulled out of the country. So today, I think during the pandemic, you had over 3 million Canadians dispersed across the world. And what that did is that created a lot of new strategy learning, new environments, new innovation that came into that. And now today, a lot of those people over 10, 20 years start to come back. And when you start coming back into the Canadian ecosystem with that new gained knowledge, you're going to build better, stronger, faster companies. And there's going to be more demand for those companies instead of the demand for the people. So I think you're seeing a lot of change in the Canadian environment for that perspective. And hopefully a lot of countries start to pick up on that opportunity. And, you know, some countries are labor focused and they don't have a choice because of the size of population. But you can still build an opportunity, which is in the, you know, 20-30% of the country, where you can start to build out that innovation, the strategic side, sending people abroad to learn, and then have them come back. And that reinvents your entire country and how you're operating as in GDP and growing your economies of scale through resourcing. So I think Canada is becoming a prime example of how that can work with a smaller number of people and size of property or size of land mass. But it is certainly changing a lot. And not to get into the world of economics, I sound like I'm a professor or something, and we're doing a course on distribution.
That's awesome. Professor Potvin's holding class right now. This is terrific.
Yeah. All right, class, put your hand up. But this has really been, it's been exciting. And because I've had the opportunity to work within this environment and see so much of this change, it's pretty exciting. And I think the government has a lot more work they can do to continue supporting startups through taxation for entrepreneurs or early stage funding, where it's, we'll give you $10,000 just to kick off a project, and utilizing those types of funds, not as investment, but doing them as a way to create innovation. You know, and you can't do a lot with 10,000, but you can. And that's the difference, is that an entrepreneur can do so much more with $10,000 than anybody else. So there's different ways where you can stimulate growth and opportunity and test things and try things. And that's what entrepreneurship's all about. And hopefully the Canadian government and the Canadian ecosystem continues to work in that direction. And you're going to see even more innovation in the future, but hopefully more ESG and country building, but also environmentally protecting and allowing other countries to catch on and follow suit to the types of changes we can make.
Oh, that's awesome. I feel like you answered part of this question. I'm curious. So we had a good friend of yours, Jeff Wallace, on the show not too long ago, and he literally runs a company or an organization in Silicon Valley in your pocket, right? So my follow-on question to Ilya's question is, it sounds like the main difference between the Canadian entrepreneurial economy and the US entrepreneurial economy might just be this level of government support and focus, like the intentionality about it. But that's just what I think I heard. So why don't you tell me from your perspective as an investor who invests across the globe, who works across the border, you know, how do you think, say, the Canadian entrepreneurial economy compares and contrasts with just the US?
Well, if you look at on a global scale, each economy is set up a little bit differently. You have capitalistic markets like a US, you have socialistic markets or like Canadian. So everything is set up in a different way. So when a country is set up to make money versus a country that's set up to support its people, you know, Canada is like the tree-hugging society, right? We're about government support and help and getting the hug when we need it. Whereas in the US, it's about individual growth and opportunity and capitalistic, like you need to be your own island. You need to make your own money or you're not going to survive. We'll help you a little bit, but it's going to be very hard to find. So I think a lot of these have to find a middle ground. And where that middle ground is obviously a blend of these environments. And not everybody wants to go into a blend. Not everybody wants to say that we need social programs to help you build your company, build it yourself, you know, go to your friends and family. And when you start to look at countries like Ecuador and Mexico or even all the way into Asia and other pockets, they have a blend. So like Ecuadorian side, you can go to the bank for funding, but the problem is that you need to have an asset to build against it. In order to have an asset, you have to buy a home, and then you can put your company against that. So the liability and risk is shifted, and it's shifted because of the same issue, is that we don't want to be left holding the bag if you can't figure out how to build this into a business. Philippines, when I first put an investment to that country, you had to have five local family members that had to be part of the company, or five people from the country. And that was to de-risk it again. So if you screw up, foreigner, or you screw up in this business, someone's going to be accountable. So throughout these regulations, it was always about self-protecting so you don't lose value in the country or in that business or that area. So now what you're seeing is the Philippines have reduced those things. You don't need five founders that are local. You need one or two. And why do they change it? Because over time, they learned that, wait, we get more businesses and more revenue and more GDP growth if we take more risk. So how do we start to enable risk in our own country? How do we take in our people and support them instead of supporting everybody else in the world? How do we support our own people and believe in the brain power that we have and start to put more money into education, put more governance into education so that we know we're going to have these types of outcomes? And India is the prime example of that. You have a country 15, 20 years ago that didn't support education as strongly as they could. And what they did is they started to say, hey, we need to be on top of engineering. We've got enough people. Let's do that. Well, today, India pushes out more engineers than any country in the world. And where in the world is all these engineers going? Everywhere. Why? Because they need that strength and that knowledge. And that came from 20 years of putting money in education and money into engineering. And Canada did something very similar when it was in biotech and health tech areas. It was predominantly male dominated. And then 10, 15 years ago, they said, wait, we need to focus on distributing this around multiple sexes. So why don't we start to push this more for females and see if this will make a difference? Well, today, I think it's something like 78 or 82% of all health and biotech is female based.
Wow.
Wow.
So it literally had a mass exodus and it proved that there was a real big need for female innovation inside of this space. So wow. Now you've changed the dynamics. So how do other countries pick up on this and say, hey, maybe if we promote this area and show that this area really could use this type of intervention of female, male, or however you choose to define that, and see how we can change the way that works. And that's what every country has to start looking at. How do we test where we can diversify and change, but also how do we support the people there and how do we give them the right person to speak to? Because a lot of people do want to look for people that are like them. And when it comes to startup world, they want people that have experience. So, and you can take yourself, Rob, you're taking the Americanized capitalistic view and you're taking that and you're putting this into Spanish speaking cultures globally, and they're leaning on you and you're sharing all this great insight. Think of how much you're changing the role and dynamics of those people in those countries on how they look at how a company starts or how a company builds. It's phenomenal. Take you and print it out 1,000 times, and now you're going to have that much more value going into all of these countries. They could utilize that type of mentorship, coaching, because you're taking that 100 years of development in a capitalistic market and putting it into an environment where they're not used to that, and they don't understand how to fend for themselves at a larger scale versus just a small shop or something that's fending just for the family. So some of these things can be utilized and exploited, but it takes time. So the more people you have doing it and the more government support that you can put in there that's regulated so that it doesn't get abused, can then build up the economies inside of each of these different countries. And that builds protection for everybody.
Fascinating. That was the level 201 class right there. By the end of the show, we're going to be at PhD level stuff here. This is fantastic.
Yeah. JP, we want to know more about your story. We want to know more, how do you start in the entrepreneurial ecosystem? Do you have some background in your family? We already know you have found some companies, also sold ones, but how does it start?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it starts from when I was a kid. Okay. I don't think it started family-wise. My parents are corporate. My mother was a stay-at-home mom until we were probably, I think, maybe 9. And then my father and the family decided that my mother wanted to do way more. So we said, hey, look, we'll support this. I'm saying we, I was eight, like I had any choice and knew what was going on. But my mother wanted to go back to school. She wanted to get her, I think it's GDP, and then get her college and do all of that. And she did. So she went through all of that. And as a family, we were able to support that. And I think that was pretty exciting. We didn't really like my father cooking because he made peas every night. So I can say that that wasn't the most eventful time. But
no one would like that for dinner every night.
No, he wasn't creative. But what did come out of it is that my mother went on to have a successful career, and she was able to support a lot of different things. But she was quite driven. But I think what we gained from that as kids was that we had to learn little innovative things to support ourselves, and ways to make money and the ways to kind of build through, because again, we didn't have that, as most, you know, kids probably didn't. So I think from there, you know, I was learning stories about when I was a kid. And interestingly enough, I've never really shared these things, so I guess I'll throw some of them out there for fun. I don't tend to do too many interviews of myself, but
we love it.
when I was a kid, I had a paper route for one. But I was always a fan of trying to find ways to make money and find ways to support myself. I didn't like, you know, introverted kid, didn't like to have to depend on other people. So I had to find my own ways. So my mother told me when I was 5, 6 years old, we had a flea market, and I went down and sold all my toys. So I had some money. I was 5 years old. I'm like, really? I needed money that bad at 5. So I guess I was pretty dynamic. You know, I found all my own worms. I did all the things. So when I went fishing, and I fished for food. So I would bring home fish for we could eat. So I found different ways around that. And then as I got older, I used the paper route as another way. Like, it's kind of funny, but I used to sell, the newspaper was 25 cents. This is how old I am. And I would go out door to door, and I would knock because I knew that I needed to sell 50 papers because that's what they sent me. And I had to pay for that. So it forced me out of my shell to say, I got to knock on 5,400 doors to sell 50 papers. And so I did. And that was 25 cents a paper. And then I had innovative things that came across my mind. So when I was a kid, it drove me crazy that in my bedroom I had a dresser and that I had all of these things. So I would take my dresser and put it in the closet. And then my mother would come and be like, what the hell? This doesn't need to be here. Move it back out. And then the next day, I put it back in the closet because I needed more room to visualize and play or whatever. So I started to do those things. And then my mind's running 100 miles an hour on where I got all these things from. But another one was socks. My mom had, you know, those little white socks that had the balls on the end?
Yeah.
They were, I don't know what kind of socks they were for tennis players or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But this was before they were like, well, I took those socks because I was a minimalist. So I didn't like long socks. And we were kids, we had to wear these socks that went up to your knees.
Yeah.
So I would take my mom's socks, cut the balls off them, and I would wear those socks for running and for everything I did.
Because so you were way ahead of the curve, because the low sock ankle socklet thing didn't come in until like the 2000s. Like, so
yes. Oh, I used to go back to my parents and say that. I'm like, why didn't you take some of these innovations? We did closet building. We took socks. I put wheels on hockey skates. Like, I found different ways to
wait. Hold on. Wait. You essentially made your own pair of rollerblades.
Yeah. But I didn't know it was anything. It was just solving a problem, which was I wanted to do something different. Now, I may not have exploited it by running around and riding down the streets at 100 miles an hour with these things. But what I was doing, and just to this point, was that I was a builder. I was a solutionist.
Yes.
And what I come to realize, and I was with Jeff in San Francisco 2 weeks ago, Jeff and Cal, and we were out and we were chatting. And Jeff and Cal are phenomenal. These guys are amazing. Yeah. So big fans of what they're doing. And what came out of this was that we were chatting and they asked, you know, kind of how businesses run. And one of the things I shared was that there's two sides to a business. And the two sides are that you have a front runner and you have a solutionist. This is the perfect ideal solution for a company. And if you take it like a Jeff Bezos or a Bill Gates, they're the front runner. So they are the front person. They are the person that talks and runs and delivers. They're the ones that are always pitching and selling the idea. The difference is that they're selling it new every day. And when they make that sell, they sell through, they go back to the solution. They say, look, I just pitched it. We do this. We don't really do this. You need to make this happen. And then that solution makes that happen. Those are the two main elements that you need to have a successful business or a successful entrepreneur growth. So in my case, I didn't want to be the front person. I always wanted to be the solutionist. So you can be the inventor and come up with the solutions, but they don't go anywhere if you don't have somebody that can go out and sell and be that front runner. So how do you find that front runner? So over the years, didn't really find the front runner until kind of where I am today. But through innovation and through testing and trying and failing, and those fails were on my own time. They were things that I saw that didn't work. Or you got pushback from other people, like my mother telling me to stop putting my dresser in the closet. you got pushback from people, but if you believe in it enough and you believe that this change is everybody needs it, it eventually will morph into something that becomes bigger than you. But that takes a front runner and someone that can drive it. So throughout my, I guess, career that got me started in these businesses, it was from that practical side of trying and testing. Getting pushback, it didn't mean I actually solved it. Like, I wish I could have come out with these stocks when I was 8. And today you can, because a lot of 8-year-olds are building companies because their parents and online have more interest and more knowledge. So that's a phenomenal change that's happened in the environment. But at that time when I was going through it, it wasn't so much of a support. It was a bunch of things that weren't there to learn what you could do or you couldn't.
What were the companies that you built?
Well, again, they were trial and error because as you built them, you just said, I can't do anything because you weren't front running it. You weren't out selling it. So you were solving a problem for yourself. And there's a great podcast that I listened to a long time ago. And it was something like, if you took the amount of, there's like $2 billion worth of revenue generated from small innovations that people have never figured out how to actually commercialize them. They're just someone that found a way to change something real quickly. Like the Swiffer, when the Swiffer came out, that was something that everybody's done a million times. I'm sure someone had a mop and put a cloth on the end of it and was cleaning the room. So someone actually came up with that, but never figured out that I could turn this into a product. Someone walked by and saw this and decided, wow, and they went and turned it into an innovation and then turned it into an entire industry. So I think there's a lot of that that goes on, but people don't recognize that the little changes that they've made could really be turned into something bigger, because we all make these little changes to our lifestyle because of innovation that we come up with. So in our time, when I first created my first company, which was Heartboot, which we still run today in resourcing, I actually pitched it to two of the senior level directors at Loblaws back in early 2000s when I was there, 2001, about the business. They didn't have the entrepreneurial spirit, so they didn't have that same understanding of driving out to do it. But that was my first, hey, we should do something like this. And I was already building code and building other things at home on my own, building networks and making networks for other people. But I never looked at, again, those things on how do I take this passion of something I've built and make it into something bigger and assume the risk and then get other people to assume the risk with me. That was always the fear, is I never wanted to bother people. So I couldn't get outside of that shell. So eventually I created Heartboot, and I think I booked the URL was in 1996, I think. I was 3 weeks, someone else got Heartboot.com 3 weeks before I went in to buy it. And it was because I was sitting at home working and coding, and I wanted to do a name that exemplified my passion for starting something new and also for turning it on. Like, cold booting is when you turn a computer on. Hard booting is the exact same thing. You're taking it from an off state to an on state, which is cold or hard booting. So that's how I came up with the name. And then communications was originally part of that part because I was terrible at communicating. So I thought, okay, maybe if I force it in my name, it'll make me do more communicating. I don't know if it worked, but they were both two concepts that helped me kind of work forward. So if you take all of those times and all of the things that you re-engineer and you develop, I think that a lot of it is just being able to meet the right people that say, hey, I want to learn more about you, learn how to ask questions, which is obviously what you're doing on a podcast. And those questions can pull out that information that would make somebody think, hey, you know what? I've actually invented three things I didn't even know I did. You know, I built this little thing that I bring on the plane that lets me put my iPad on so I can watch my iPad. Well, that little innovation could be worth billions, but we don't think of it because it just solved a little minor problem for us and we just went on with our day. So at the end of the day, there's a lot of innovation we're missing. And that comes from, I think, being able to have engagements with mentors and coaches like what you're doing that helps people really define and come up with these great new businesses that they never thought they could possibly build.
Yeah. You clearly, I know you well enough and you just articulated it, like you clearly take all these experiences and you're constantly looking at like, how can I fix that? How can I do that better? How can I, right? Like you're just one of those people who goes through life. I always say to young entrepreneurs, like, if we start this program today and you come in tomorrow and you're not sure about what you're going to work on, I was like, take a pad of paper and a pencil, and on the bus ride between home and here tomorrow, just make note of all the things that don't work the way that you would wish they would work, right? And somewhere in that big crazy list is going to be a half dozen amazing ideas of real products or real solutions that you could build. So it sounds like you've been essentially living life like that since you were a kid, and you've regurgitated that into a number of different businesses, some your own, some with partners. But now let's jump forward to kind of a lot of your recent chapter work, right, with OPN. So you've also taken a lot of these lessons and said, I'm gonna give them back. Like, I'm gonna apply them to a world that's just bigger than just me creating new businesses and new products and new inventing new stuff. I'm gonna help other people figure out how to do this. So tell us about kind of the birth moment of OPN. Tell us what it stands for, what it is, and then let's kind of take the journey from there.
For sure. So throughout the journey of building different companies and working with a lot of different operators and investing in companies at the same time, you become observant to where things fail, why things fail, where the successes come from, and what kind of really lines up to what defines you. So as an example, you meet somebody in a classroom or in a business and you think, wow, this person's phenomenal. And you start to really learn a bit about what they're doing in their journey. And you start to realize, why am I becoming attached to want to help this person? And you realize this person carries characteristics that you had maybe at that age. So you become drawn to figuring out, how can you help them maneuver through what they're doing quicker and faster so that they don't have to go through the pitfalls that you went through? So there's a point in time where your journey starts to shift from, I'm on this journey by myself, just building and growing and taking the learning and taking the defeat and the wins, and that you decide that, wow, you know what, maybe there's more of an opportunity here to give back and to support these other companies so that they can move quicker. And if I can support them through mentorship or coaching, whatever that might be, that's what I want to do. And there was a point where about 6-7 years ago, you know, building a company, investing in companies, there was a point where I just kind of had this wake up moment where I was just saying, you know what, I really want to give back. I want to share to help other entrepreneurs with the knowledge that I've gained. You know, it's not easy. It's the toughest job in the world, or I'm going to say that. I'm sure everybody says their job's the toughest, but being your own boss and paying your own bills and doing all that, that's got to be the toughest job. And now it's figuring out, how do I balance and be innovative, and how do I change where I am, and do I want to be a $1 billion company, or do I want to be a $100 million company? Like, what do I want to do and how do I get there? And then how do I shift and share this knowledge without it being overwhelming, intrusive, but enough that we can all learn and go forward? But the difference is that when you learn from mistakes. So how do you learn from someone that's punching down at you saying, hey, do this, change this? And you're like, no, I'll do it myself. Why? Because you want to have that learning, but there's also another way to feed that information out without it being forced or felt that I'm just learning from someone for no reason, but I'll never use it. Like in high school, I learned algebra. Have I ever used algebra? No, people say you haven't, but technically you have. And through all of the things you do in life, you're using that base level knowledge in order to build spreadsheets and do everything that you're doing, but you don't look at it that way at the time. You just think, I'll never use algebra. This is terrible. So how do you feed enough information throughout your journey that when you start to fall and solve problems, it's not because you learned this from a talk yesterday. It's because you learned it when you were in school, and the process of the programming that you went through helped you solve problems quicker. And that experience and coaching caught up so that when you are at that moment, you take 5 minutes and breathe. Not every problem needs to be solved in 5 seconds. That's pressure. That means it's someone's robbing you. Take a second, breathe, walk away, close the door, think about it. Now you can actually make the process of, is this the right direction I should go? Take a moment. We don't learn that if we don't go through that process. So how do you give back? And that's where I decided to just start moving around and figure out what I could do. I went back to one of the colleges I had graduated from. I went to the universities I went to, and I went back to the experience I had, and I said, hey, I would love to jump into entrepreneurship and help teach and coach and whatever I can do. So that they came to us and said, hey, we got a plan. We've got this mentorship group. Why don't you join it? Why don't you run events here? Why don't you teach here? And that's what we did. So I started jumping into there. And then I went in and said, you know, I love football, soccer, American soccer or football. And I said, you know, maybe I'm going to coach. I need to get back into my passion, things that really drive me. So I started coaching football all at the same time. So I was just swamped. But I loved it. It felt invigorating that you could help young people with questions that they had, or you could help people see something differently or challenge things differently. And so that's how it started. And about 7-8 years back, I started jumping in, or 7 years ago, I started jumping into teaching and coaching. And what I gained from that was immense knowledge of what young people thought about football at the time, what they thought about the world. What came out of the next one was teaching, which is, you know, how do I innovate and change the way teaching works? Because I looked at teaching and I thought, I can't go and stand in front of the class and just regurgitate information. That's not how I want to learn. So I started to change how I would approach teaching. And I taught probably 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, I had taught for a few years as well, just as a side job. I built a business around it and then decided just to walk away when I got too busy in corporate. But what I learned from that was that, one, I was never meant to be in front of people. So this teaching actually got me in front of people. So it opened me up. A quick story was that I rewrote all the curriculum for every course I taught because I was so scared to get in front of people with just the book knowledge that I had to rewrite it all. So I rewrote every course.
Oh, wow.
And I couldn't sleep the night before every program because I was so nervous to get in front of a class full of people. So I'd stay up all night and I would regurgitate all the information so that by the time I went to class, even if it was 8-hour class, I knew everything I could possibly know so there couldn't be a way I could make a mistake. And then I would go home and sleep for the 2 days because the anxiety was so bad.
Wow.
And the only reason that changed was because about a year into this, while I was teaching, I was using a marker on the board and I blacked out because I hadn't slept in so long. And I hit my head on the blackboard and then I caught myself and the whole class was like, oh my God. And I turned around and I was like, sorry guys, I hadn't slept and I didn't realize it. And that was the last time that I didn't believe in myself when it came to being able to be in front of people. And it took me a year. So I would say it takes me 1 year to get comfortable in front of people.
Because as you can tell, Ilay, he's socially awkward and an introvert. Like, he totally...
The students never forgot about you. They will never.
No, it was crazy. So I remember, like, as a teen, I can tell you every public speaker that I met throughout my life because I was so amazed by what they accomplished. By just doing a speech in front of me, or when I was in grade 5, I watched this guy, Sandy Wakeling. He did a talk when he was in grade 8. I can tell you the whole speech, what it was about, because I was mesmerized
by how
he got in front of people and how he could do that. So you take those learnings throughout life and you try to put them into your own, like, how do I get away from my own uncomfortableness? But that's where I started to give back, and I learned that, you know, I have to challenge myself. That's what gets me going. But even today, I still go through the same issues, which is when I'm talking or I'm on this, I haven't slept. I had the worst sleep last night. Why? Because of the nerves of having to talk on 2 podcasts. Even when I do my own podcast, same thing.
Don't have to be nervous with us,
buddy. It's just therapy. This is just therapy.
It's amazing what you learn, though. It's amazing what you learn about yourself.
Founder therapy. Okay, give us some context. So 7-8 years ago, you're learning how to teach. You're deciding to give back. OPN, Open People's Network, becomes a community organization that you feel at the time like doesn't exist in Toronto, inside of the Toronto startup ecosystem. And so you're like, hey, what if I do this? And then that takes a life of its own in the years since then.
Yeah, it was another kind of, I find I tell people this all the time, listen to the voices around you. And I don't mean crazy stuff. I mean, listen to the voices around you because they help you without you knowing they're helping you. And I was asked to go onto a podcast, and this was probably 7.5 years ago. I was asked to go on one, and his name was Ricardo. And he said, come on, I'm going to talk about work efficiencies. So I said, sure. I jumped onto the podcast, and it was 4 boxes, kind of like we're doing here, except for there was 4. And we did this interview, and you could bring people in, and they could ask questions. It was a really cool platform. And at the end of it, I was so excited. I called him up. I said, hey, man, is it possible that I could use your platform? He's like, it's not mine. I'm like, could I use the software? And would you be okay if I build a podcast? I said, I want to interview people. This is so amazing. And he was like, yeah, of course. So I started to find ways to get in front of people that I thought were really cool, that would really be able to learn from myself, because obviously you want to learn from people. So that's all I cared about. And then I'll put it out so everybody else can learn. So that was kind of the onset to where Open People Network came from. So we started to work more and more and more with founders and get into interesting conversations. And then there was a point where I was investing and I started to realize every company that's pitching us, there's 12 of the same company. It was driving me crazy. And this is last week, we pitched 20 companies to us, they're all the same. So how do we go in and say, hey, you guys should work together? And maybe this is something that we could push. So okay. We decided maybe we could build a community so that the more people that saw that everybody was building the same thing, maybe they would then look at the business differently. They'd say, I need to challenge this and be a little bit different or go work with these guys. So Open People Network was around the premise of let's build a community where people can be open-minded, open, and talk about their business.
Open to listen.
And they can share. Yeah, open to listen, open to share. And if they do this, then when they're pitching, maybe other people will say, hey, I love what they're doing. I love this model. I want to work for you. Or, hey, I want to invest in you. So we started running events with different districts in the country. And what that did is it opened up. We had the city of Toronto say, hey, we want you to come in and run your events through us. So we became one of a few sponsors, which was really great. They loved the model. And we took care of all the costs. It was all free and predominantly mostly that way. And the idea was that we wanted to get founders in front of investors. So we made it all about the founder. We didn't make it about the sponsors and about investors. We said, we want to give the four face all of this to the startup because the startup's going to have the toughest journey of their life and nobody cares about them. They care about money. They care about the big brands. So let's make it about them and give them their day and their time and their limelight. And that's what we did. So we made it about them. And that's where we started to build a community around that people really enjoyed coming to our events because they felt important. They felt that this was about us. And then that continued to build on and build on. And then we started to find different ways that how can we bring more value to these founders? And then how can we continue to offset the way the model works and give people back information so that they can make the right decisions in order to get investment or get in front of investors? So we tied all those elements together. And today we've made a few modifications, but we're now focused in on a couple different areas that bring value to a new group. Which is general partners, and we're focusing on them because they're the feeder system to the companies getting money. So how do we make them important now? Because now you've got these founders that are going to be trying to get in front of them, and that's where we shifted OPN. The fund has shifted to acquisitions globally, and now we've got these two areas that are focused on the people that are going to be spreading their money and the people that are going to be merging their companies so that Open People Network can continue to be the facilitator to collectively combine great ideas into great businesses.
Wow.
So that's when you found the Supporters Fund.
We built Supporters Fund 5 years ago. And the reason that came about was that instead of just me investing, we found that it was a little slow. I can only make so many investments in a year. I thought, well, you know what? Maybe there's a way that if we start investing other people's money, we could build something up more valuable. So we started because we were part of a lot of angel networks. We said, well, why don't we go out and show them what we've done? We had a few exits before that through personal investments, et cetera. So we utilized that to build up a value. And then people saw that we were good money managers, that we have built trust, you built a community. So community is number one. And I've known Rob's told me this many, many times. It's all about community. It's about building people that believe in your passion, your dream. And when you do that, the community will help rise. You know, it helps build everybody up. So that community was pretty powerful to us. And we wanted to keep utilizing that in the right fashion. And that's how we kind of focused it. So the fund became a way to invest in a larger subset into these groups. And then from there, now we've taken that learning. Because everything's about learning, right? If you bucket everything as an experiment, and then you take what you've built and you go full-fledged on it. So the first two funds, experimental, figure out what our line is. What's the line of sight? Where do we become the best at who we are? And now we found what that model fits, and now we're pushing the model out and going to raise for it.
And what are some examples of companies that you have invested in? One of your favorites or just
Well, they're all my favorite.
Yeah. It wasn't a good question.
No, it's a very good question. There's always ones that stand out, and they stand out because of the founder, the business, the model, and what they solve. But, you know, if you look back at what makes a difference in a business, if they win or they fail, is what they did to get there. Like, if they're a solutionist, how good was their solution? Where did they have their shortcomings? Where did they have their upside to go valuable? You're always going to look at a company and say, well, they exited, so that must be your most successful. And yes and no, that always can carry some weight both ways. But I think the exciting part is what you get to learn from the group that you're working with, but also how much did they change the way you look at something. So I'll look at, say, Float Water, because I'm a fan of what they've done. But they looked at, on the CPG side, they looked at we have a very big commoditized product, which is water and plastic. How can we change that and modify and innovate and then provide a better product, better solution, and then be the brand that nobody else has been in that category? And that was what really changed my mindset in, this is one way of looking at investing instead of saying it has to be unique and different. That's the only way I invest. It's just IP, IP. Those are great ways, but there's also branding, which is I'm going to own a category and I'm going to be the best. And people are going to want our product because we have a great product. We've innovated the product. And then we became the brand that everybody wants in that space. ESG based, health style, all of those things. And that's what Nicholas and the Flow team did. Other companies that fit into that space, say Rover Parking, they looked at social parking and said, you know what, why don't we commoditize your parking space? So they went around in Canada and North America and started getting properties to open up their parking space. So innovative, you know, I have a home parking spot that nobody's using. I'm going to sell it. I'm going to sell it to people to use. So 6-7 years ago, dove into that. And that company got acquired by a US-based company. And now they're part of a larger network of, hey, this is an asset class that no one looked at. Other asset classes that you can start to look at, and that's really the job of the money manager, right? How do I find other asset classes that maybe don't exist that could be turned into larger base asset class and then merged into larger companies to create a larger value and a larger AUM? And that's really where you get that exciting innovation come from. And that's how we kind of have to look at every type of investment we work with. They all have to have some sort of intrinsic value for today, but also in the future, can they continue to grow and build, or do they go away because people get bored of using that piece of equipment that they don't need anymore?
Yeah. You've put so much energy into Toronto and your area, but I know part of where you draw your inspiration and really our origin story, like, is that you love to travel. I want to know two things. Why? And then aside from the personal impact, professionally, do you find it informs your investment decisions and or do you find opportunities out there on the road? So why do you travel as much as you do and how much have you traveled?
Opening up Pandora's box here. Well, it's interesting because, and I think you alluded to it before, when you have a weakness and your weakness, you know what those are, people, interactions, those types of things. You have to put yourself into awkward positions in order to grow. So I knew as a kid that I had crazy hairdos, crazy clothes, because I had to draw attention to me, because I wouldn't go to you. I could sit beside you on a plane for 10 hours and never say a word, because in my head I would want to say something, but I couldn't find the window or the gap to open up and share. So what I learned was that if I have something that's approachable, then people will approach me and then I can have that conversation. So my weakness was that I wasn't very good at those different things. So I had to push myself into an awkward spot that forced me to have to engage. So what I would do is that, this was a long time ago when I started my first company, I said, I want to build a company that allows me to travel. I want to see the world. And where that came from is that when I was in school, in college, a professor walked in the room and he introduced himself, and I apologize, I don't remember his name. And he was an international business professor. And he said, I have been to 73 countries. And I was like, wow, that is amazing. And I was like, 73 countries. How did you do this? That's all I care about. And throughout the whole class, we got to learn different cultures. I got to learn about how people engage in a meeting in France. They shake every hand before they start. Or you don't show your shoes in Saudi, like the bottom of your soles. So I learned all these things as a young person. And that invigorated me to have a curiosity to say, oh my God, I got to figure out how this can be part of my repertoire. So that was a longstanding dream from a long time ago, even though I didn't have context to get there. And then when I started my company, I said, I want to make sure that this is part of my mandate that I do this. So what I did was I set it up so that every December and January, I would go away for 4 to 6 weeks. And in order to force myself to meet people, because I could stay in hotels, which is normal, and I guess, I said, that's not going to change me as a person. I'll never meet anybody, and I'm cool with that, but that's not going to develop me. So I need to put it differently. So what I did is I made all of my trips, I booked a flight into one country and then a flight out of the other country. And then what I would do is I would not book anything. I literally would be on the plane with nowhere to stay, nowhere to go. So it challenged me to figure out somewhere to live and somewhere to go. Even if I didn't know the language, I had to figure it out. And I didn't know where to go. Awesome. So that's what forced me to learn. So I would stay in hostels, which means I was in bunk beds, which I was super uncomfortable with, as you can imagine. But I learned to have to talk with people. I can't get things done. Like a kid can't get anything if he doesn't ask questions. So I had to start asking questions. Where should I go? What should I see? What do you like? How do I get on this bus? So I had to learn how to communicate better. And that's what kind of started this journey, is that I didn't know the excitement until I got on the plane. Then the anxiety hit me. Oh my God, I don't even know where to go. I'm going to Poland. No one speaks English. Oh my God. Or wherever it might've been, right? So there was always that challenge, and the challenge is what made me excited about it. And that's what kept driving me. So for years I did this. And then over the last 2 years, I've spent the last 2 years traveling through, I think, 35 countries.
How many countries have you traveled so far?
Total.
Over 80 countries.
So you beat your college professor.
I did, yes.
There are 195 countries out there.
There is. Recognized by the American society, they have 195.
Right. You've done like over 30% of the world.
Do you have like a story where, you know, you just told us that you don't plan anything, that something didn't happen the way...
That it didn't go well?
Oh, I've had many stories that haven't gone well.
Have you ever sleep in the streets or something? I don't know.
the closest, I've slept in hammocks. I've slept on mattresses, floors.
Okay.
Anywhere you can think of, I've slept. Trees, in an ice igloo. I've slept in a salt igloo in Bolivia, wherever it's called, a salt hotel. But I've slept in a lot of different places. But the one that would probably stand out the most, I believe it was in Spain. I took the train. I landed on the flight, took the train, and I could not for the life of me find the place I was supposed to stay, which was the hostel. So I had booked it through Hostel World, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't find it. I was exhausted. I've been traveling for like, I don't know, 30 hours, whatever the number was. And I kept going around and around, and I could not find it. So I literally was walking down an alley to go sleep in the alley. And as I was walking down the alley, this guy out of nowhere pulls out of the alley. And he's standing there in front of me, and I got my bag on my back, and I'm going to crash in a bin somewhere. And he's like, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm just going down this alley," because I didn't want to tell the guy. I don't know who he is. And he's like, "Are you looking for somewhere to stay?" And I said, "Yeah, I kind of am." And he's like, "Oh, what place are you looking for?" And I said, "Oh, I'm looking for this place." And he's like, "That's where I'm going."
Oh,
it's like I own the place, and I was like,
"Oh, he was the owner of the hostel." Oh
my God, he know his clients.
Oh, totally, and because this was a long time ago, there wasn't the easy way to find. Google Maps wasn't exactly the most populous, easiest thing to use. I think it was on a BlackBerry, so everything was very
not even Wi-Fi. You know, like it wasn't like easy to get the information.
Exactly. So he saved that part. But this is more of a commerce story. I could go into many, many, many stories of funny, crazy things.
We will need another podcast.
Exactly.
You've survived. You've survived your travels. And you also made me think. There's another guest who's a friend of ours, Yogi Roth, who in his 20s would travel similarly and famously also did the I picked a place that I'm going to that I'd never been before, where I think I'm going to be uncomfortable, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to go with no plan. And then when I land, I'll have a plan. And that, and I'm going to misquote this, so I'll have to go back and listen to one of his stories. But his worst case scenario unfolded, I want to say it was like Ethiopia or something like that, where he literally unknowingly dropped into the middle of like a civil war and then got arrested. And had to call home and go, "Hey, I'm here," which his parents didn't know he had gone, and I got arrested. Apparently our podcast draws people like you guys.
I love it. The best part of that is that it's the story that comes out of it, and for me, it's about the story, right?
And of course,
if you don't push yourself outside your limits, you'll never figure out that story. And for me, it was, you know, I've got a lot of stories that I shared 10 years later to my folks or to someone, and they're like, you did what? This happened? And it's just because I don't want people to worry or be scared, because I always know that there's a way out around it. Somehow I'll figure it out. But again, that's the solutionist in me that says anything is solvable. You just have to have the right time and the moment to think and come up with it. So, you know, some things you'll just choose to make an action and move forward. But in most things, you do have that option to think for a second and say, how do I resolve this in the easiest, less complicated way? And, you know, sometimes you have to take the opposite side, which is sleep in an alley or whatever it might be. Those things happen. And I don't think that they're a bad thing. They still tell it for a good story. You know, sleeping on the beach and getting bit by crabs, you know, those things happen.
Oh, yeah. No, all great stories are not necessarily stories with good endings. Like, they can still be a great story.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's 100% true. All right. So, dude, you promised us when we started the show that you were going to literally use stories to tell some of your story, which you have done marvelously. And you've taken us through just an awesome journey that goes from paper route kid, which I was as well, by the way, for two terrible winters. I'll never forgive my dad for that. And you've taken us all the way through kind of your, how you learn. That's a lot of what I hear, like your learning journey, and then how you've learned by learning about how you learn, how you've learned to interact with other people. And all of those are lessons for the entrepreneurs and the investors. And it's solving. If I heard two themes, Ilay, I heard two. It was solving problems and people. Right? Communication. Yeah. Even though you openly say, and I've known this as your friend, like, people is not your thing. Like, you're not strong at this. You are introverted. You are socially awkward in some circumstances.
But you don't look like that.
Right. But you have this engineer's approach to getting better at that and having it be less of an obstacle to your life, which is super admirable.
Yes, it's the time for you to share three pieces of advice for our audience in whenever you want.
I love it. Well, I think because we were talking about travel, and I do see and hear a lot of people that say they want to travel or they want to make it part of their repertoire of life. The advice I would share on the travel side is, you know, just as I had found a solution to the problem, which is I want to travel more, what could I build a solution around? And I think, like anything in life, you have to kind of find what gets you excited for that journey. Getting excited just to say you traveled to a country maybe doesn't have the same pull for you to get there. So you need to find what changes and what makes you a better person. And in my case, it changed me how I interacted with people. It forced me to speak with people. It forced me to solve problems on the spot so that I could move forward. And now today, when I land in a country, it's like me going downtown Toronto. I can walk around and do anything I need, and I do not even feel uncomfortable whatsoever being in another country, from Istanbul to Singapore to Saudi to South Africa. I don't notice a difference. Everybody looks the same to me in the sense that they are just people and they're all on their own journey. And the excitement part is that I have the opportunity to learn from these people in their society and their culture. And I can take that back on my journey and share that with everybody else. And I can also decentralized, but I can also compress the fact that these places are all just as safe as the place you live in. And that there is so much out there that you can learn and so many people that are just freaking awesome. And, you know, if I didn't challenge myself, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here with you guys. If I didn't look at the world in a different lens, I wouldn't have the opportunity to meet people in different cultures. And I think that's what really helped me find my way in what invigorates me. And I can't wait for that next trip. You know, coming back a week ago and sitting at home, everybody's like, when are you leaving again? And I said, you know, I as much as I want to leave tomorrow, is that I'm going to stay here for a bit and, you know, take it in and figure out what we're doing next and keep working on ourselves and our business. But they're right, is that you do try to figure out what's that next solution or what's that next piece that I can fit into, what's that next country I need to go to meet startups and meet investors and all of that. That all comes through the journey. But I think you have to have a reason that drives you there. And my reason was that it helped me solve my problem of how I interact with people. And it allowed me to now interact even better. And the example I'll give is that when I was in Dubai and I went to this restaurant to eat. It's a long station. I would never ask these questions because I felt it was intrusive. But when I went into there, there was four guys working in the place and two other people that were talking. And I just had asked at the cash register, I said, "Hey, where are you from? You don't look like you're from Dubai." And he said, no, we're from Morocco. And we built the business here. And I was like, "Oh my God, that's incredible. I love Morocco." And they were like, "Really? You've been?" And I said, "Yes, man, I've been to Morocco. I was just there. It was so exciting." I said, "I went to a football match," because I go to football matches in every country. And I said, "It is by far the most amazing football match I've ever been to in any country. And I mean this." I said, "The only other one that would compare to this travel was when I was in Israel. I went to a game in Beersheba." I said, "That's the only one that's equivalent." And then I pulled out my phone and I showed them the football match. And I swear to God, these guys were like on top of the counters cheering. "That's my hometown. That's my team." They were so excited about that interaction that it gave me goosebumps, because I never thought, wow, I can't believe that I'm connecting with somebody through a football match because I was in their country.
Total strangers.
Total strangers. But it was the pride of that you respected my country, that you came to my country and you experienced what I go through. And in this football match, if I showed you, and I will share it, the stadium is just lit up. There are firebombs going off everywhere. The place is going crazy.
Football in the Middle East / South Asia.
Totally. So that really drove it. And that's where I felt, wow, what I've done is I found a way to connect with people that I never thought I could, because I never thought I had anything of importance or value. That now I can share that being connected to someone through an experience I had in their country. And it's not that I stayed on their beach. It's because I was integrated into their culture. Yeah. So if there is advice I give about life, is get out there, find a reason to push yourself, get in there and do it, and then make it a habit. Make it something that keeps driving you. And what you'll find is solutions that you can solve problems to, not only in that environment, but in your own environment. And when you do that in your own environment, you'll find a way to build your own company, because you'll find ways to keep creating solutions. So don't look at everything through the same lens that everybody else does, which is, this is how it has to be. Look at it as, how can I change this to be better for the rest of the world, and change it in a way that other people want to get behind it and take it and make this something valuable?
Yeah, it's funny. You have a very, I've said it a couple times now, right? You have like the engineer's approach to serendipity, right? So like you are a person who allows that story about the Moroccan guys in the cafe, right, with the soccer, who allows serendipitous moments to happen, but you engineer your way into those, right? So like you say, "I'm going to schedule this time every year to travel when I was young." You say, "I'm going to start my business that allows me to travel." You say, "When I travel, I know I'm not going to meet enough people because naturally I would just hide in my hotel. So I'm going to force myself to be in hostel." So if folks were listening, the subtlety of the lessons there isn't just travel, be curious, be open to other people. It was like, plan it. Like, if you're not naturally this way, if you're not naturally an explorer, curious, an adventurer, like, build a plan, put it on a calendar, make a spreadsheet, like, put a schedule to it. Force yourself to do it. That's awesome. That's rare, too. It's not as common.
It lines you up to it. It lines you up to
it. It's very rare. We sit back in life and we wait for life to happen to us. Like, I wish I'd travel more. And then, like, we're disappointed when we don't later, right? It's like some things in life you can make happen and still be surprised by them.
Look at I asked ChatGPT, what were the top five questions that were asked of you? What do you think they were?
Oh, I can't even imagine.
So the curiosity of working with one of the smartest systems in the world, and the top five questions asked, the number one question was, how do I lose weight?
Yeah, of course.
This is the thing that we want to ask the smartest system in the world, because we think that that is the most important thing on our mind. Not, is the moon landing real, or is this, how's a star made? No, it's the most asked questions, which blows my mind, because it looks at me and think, man, there's so much out there that you can ask questions about. Things that you can control, and there's things you can't. Why not learn about the things you can't control and things that are just so out of the ordinary and figure out how they work?
All right, so let's close this up. This has been fantastic. I'm grateful for you for sitting in the other chair, which you don't usually do. So that was really fun. How can people find, I know you're not super social media guy, but how can people in Toronto or in the area find the OPN? How can they become part of the network? How can they make sure they come to your events? And then how can people find or connect to you if they want?
You bet. So you can find us on LinkedIn. So it's under my name, Jeffrey Podvin. You can find us on same thing on LinkedIn. So all social media under Open People Network or supportersfund.com and or hardbootinc.com. So these are all URLs that will bring you to where we are and where we're going. On the social front, the team does a fantastic job to connect to as many environments as we can, share and feed out as many of the things that are going on in the environment, from startups to business building, whatever that might be. So even if the content you guys have, feel free to share it along. The team would love to support and keep supporting what you guys are up to.
Awesome.
And the last thing I'll share is that my social media side, it was a conversation that I had with Rob. I asked him how he was so good at interacting with people, if you remember the conversation in Chihuahua. And I was just so amazed by how he connects with people. So I had to pick his brain over breakfast. He shared all these insights and he really got me so excited about it that I had an Instagram account, which is the only account I use. And my name was not my name. So I didn't connect with many people. And he invigorated me so much that I changed it to my personal name. That's how much he influenced me by saying, no, get out there and do that. And then I flew home that afternoon. And I never sweat so bad in my life over the anxiety that I just told the whole world that this is my Instagram account. I couldn't change it. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I did this. And then when I landed, I eventually went on. I can't remember if I changed it right away or I left it. But today I have left it. I did change it again the other day. But throughout the last few years, I left it open because of your advice and all the things you shared. But you really did open me up to, you know, that comfort side of sharing again and being awesome about the share and not being scared to open up about that. And I appreciate that. So you guys are great. And I had to thank you for that. So
no,
you guys are amazing.
I appreciate it. Thank you, bud. We loved having you on the show. You're awesome. You're a unique personality, a unique person in the world. We're grateful that you were part of the show, gave us some of your time. And we are grateful for all the information about Canada, the Canadian ecosystem, the opportunities there, the comparisons to the other markets, the just inspiring information for entrepreneurs and investors alike. So thanks, buddy.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
As always, we thank you so much for listening. Today's show was recorded in Los Angeles and Guadalajara, produced by Deanna Bernal in Mexico City, and promoted by the content team at Growth Hacks in Tijuana, Mexico. You can always find and share our show via any popular podcasting platform, as well as find us on social media at Mentors Today on Instagram. If you'd like to connect with our hosts, you can find them on Twitter or Instagram at I am Rob Ryan or at Ileana JAF. Gracias, thank you, and we'll see you next time.